Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response bidet for the 10th of Shvat. Today we're going to see a tshuva, a response of Rabbi Yitzchak Gaon of Spectors from the 10th of Shvat of Tuf Resh Kof Chet of 1868. This is from Ein Yitzchak, the first volume, Yoredeya, Simon Bet, the second response of the Yoredeya section. He's asked by a Rav Gadol, a great Rav, and in his town where this Rav was in charge, the Shochtim had agreed that they had taken an oath, what's called an oath al dat rabim. An oath al dat rabim is a way to make an oath more permanent, more less amenable to refutation. If I take a personal oath, then if something goes wrong and I realize that I really didn't mean to take that oath, and I never would have taken it had I known whatever it was that I was supposed to know, so the whole complicated set of halachot. But fundamentally, there seems to be the possibility that a chacham can nullify the oath, can say that the oath was taken under mistaken pretenses, and therefore I don't have to follow the oath. And that's like what we do with Hatarat Nedarim. The Chacham can be Matir, the sage can be Matir the oath. If we want to tread it, though, problem was, so in certain situations you want to say to people, well, you have to take an oath for me to trust that you'll do X, Y, or Z, but then I'll be nervous that you'll just find a way to be matir, the neder, you know, the oath or the vow. So if you're going to be matir, then it's not going to help me at all. So a way to make that oath less amenable to being hutar is to take the oath al dat rabim, to say I'm taking the oath and it's according to the will of the masses, the public. So if it's according to the will of the public, then if I go to a chacham and I say I never would have taken the oath, he isn't able to be matir the neder. He cannot allow the oath to take effect, to be nullified, because it's not only my opinion that went into the oath; it's also the opinion of the rabbim, of the general populace, the general people, and that's certainly that makes it a problem. So these shochtim in this town had taken their oath; they had sworn al dat rabbim that they would not assume the position of shochet. They would not assume the position of a ritual slaughter without getting permission from this Rav. And when he pointed out to them that they had violated this, there were people who were taking on positions of shochtim without coming to him to be checked, they spoke wrongly to him. They spoke back. They said, no, it's not your business. Stay out of it, or whatever they said. We don't have it recorded on the truth, but they acted that way. And now they've come to realize they were wrong, and they're trying to figure it out. And however the politics work, we don't get that in this tshuva. It's clearly, unfortunately, becomes a political issue, not just a purely halachic one. But he seems to now have the power and the ability to demand of them that they do something different about this. So the question is, what is he allowed to do? And they violated their oath, and therefore they need tshuva. As the Yerushalmi says, that an oath, the Yerushalmi is not actually quoted, but the Yerushalmi says that an oath is an extremely significant matter, and if people violate an oath, then there's great trouble there. So they need great tshuva, because they violated an oath that they took. They just violated it. So violating an oath is a terrible thing. And then the question is, what do you do about them? So what kind of tshuva do they need? And then also, the Chavos Das had held, and this is going to be an important question, he held that if somebody violated an oath to not shept, then the halacha is that his shechita is a nevela, meaning the act of shechita is a physical act, but it's a physical act that compares to, or that's linked to other factors. So, for example, if a non-Jew shechs an animal, it doesn't matter what physical motion they make, it doesn't matter what physically happened to the animal, it's not a valid shechita, it's not a valid ritual slaughter. So the Chavos Das held, and he's not the only opinion on this issue, there are others who disagree, but he held that since these people took an oath not to shech, not to ritually slaughter, unless and until they got permission, and some of them had not, that all of that shechita becomes nevelik, not a valid shechita, because they had sworn they wouldn't. And if that's true, then there's another problem, because the halacha is that in cases where shochet sells to the public nevelot or trefot, sells to the public non-kosher meat, either because the animal couldn't have been shechted because it already had an injury that was going to kill it, or because it's a nevela, something went wrong in the shechita and the slaughter, such that it wasn't properly ritually slaughtered, then they've sold the public, they've given the public nevelos and trefos, and we say in general those people can't be shochtim either. So there's a great question as to whether these people can continue to be shochtim, continue to be ritual slaughterers. And then, of course, there's a problem that they were meis panim against their rabbi. They acted disrespectfully towards their rabbi, and that here's what Chana says: v'chazot lo nishma b'tfutzot Yisrael. The Jewish diaspora doesn't have such things. So that's an odd thing to say, because I think that it's easy to find cases where people do that. It's wrong and it's terrible, but I think it's not as uncommon as Rav Yitzchak Kahneman makes it seem. But in a case, he thought, Rav Yitzchak Kahneman thought, that it's a big issue, and that this is something that was not common, and therefore needs a sharp reaction to make sure it doesn't happen again. So really, he says, my original instinct was that we would not let them ever again be shoktim. They would have lost their opportunity because of the action they did. So that's an interesting question in terms of not ever is an interesting question, because you might have easily said to yourself, well, at some point, in any case, the man who's writing to him, who's the rabbi of this town, and this is just an important insight into rabbis, and an important insight into rabbis and what they have to do, what they have to put up with. The rabbi writes to him, says, we really have to find a way to let them, because they have children who need to be supported. So the rabbi's writing to him is not, you can easily imagine somebody in that position who's appropriate honor of office had been violated, who was mistreated. You can easily imagine that he would say, well, you're on your own because you can't be shuktim anymore, and tough luck. But that's not his reaction. The reaction is, we have to find a way to help them, because even though they did these terrible things, they have children, and maybe they're really, they really regret what they did, but they have children. We need to help them be able to earn their living. So the question will be, if you have a shvu al dat rabim, can we do something about that? So he says, there's a mission, the Rav Yitzchak Kahneman says, there's a mission of the Melech who quotes a Rashba, that if somebody already violated an oath, we can be matir the neder. Remember, I started out by saying, usually hatarat nedarim. Hatarat nedarim usually involves saying that the neder really doesn't apply anymore because the person had an error in how they made it. Without that rabbim, it's usually not possible to do so. But this Rashba that the Mishnah HaMelech is quoting says that if they've already violated the oath, then we allow them to do Hatarat Nedarim, even though it's an oath of that rabbim. And the Urim V'Tumim quoted that, and so too says Rav Yitzchak Kahneman, it makes sense to say that because he points out that in a makom mitzvah will be matir such a neder, meaning if there's a situation where a mitzvah needs to get done, but there's some kind of a neder that's getting in the way of doing this mitzvah, and it's a neder al dat rabim, it was a neder that was said. Now, al dat rabim doesn't mean a specific rabim, it means just in general, we take it on the opinion or by the will of the people, of the populace. So that being true, then you might think that we can never get them to agree to Atar and Nadarim, but the inspector points out that when it comes to a Dvar Mitzvah, when it comes to a matter of Mitzvah, we halachically assume that they are the Rabbim, would in fact want us to be Mata the Neder, and therefore we allow it. Okay, Bista Mishdam and Nechaluhu. And then he says, and that makes sense, that same logic would apply to where somebody transgressed a neder, they violated their neder, and now they want to do tshuva, and getting rid of the neder will facilitate the processes of repentance. It makes sense that the rabbin would agree as well. The rabbin would say that in order to save this person from future isser, from future prohibitions, that we can be matzah the neder. So the first argument is, even though it's a neder al dat rabbin, even though it's an oath that was taken and specifically taken in such a way that you wouldn't be able to be matzah the oath, you wouldn't be able to allow the oath to be nullified, there in fact are situation where we allow that even so, and those will be situations where you have a reason to believe, you have good reason to believe that the rabbin would want that, or would want to allow that oath to be mutar, to be allowed. One example that we know of already is the case where there's a mitzvah involved, and the second case is the one that we're talking about now, which Rav Yitzchak Kahneman sees as an expansion of that idea, that since we now know the case where we are confident the rabbi would want to allow it happen, so that would apply as well to where we want somebody to be able to do tshuva. Now, you might think that that's not true because there are counterexamples. So what's the counterexample? There's Gemara in Gittin Daf Lamed Hey, Rav Yitzchak Kahneman points out, where a man marries women who he's not really allowed to marry, and he's no dare, the Gemara says he can be no dare, and that he won't marry such women anymore, and then do service in the Beit HaMikdash. Meaning the halacha was that we didn't allow him to serve in the Beit HaMikdash as a Kohen if he was married, let's say, to a divorcee who he's not allowed to marry. So the Gemara says he can take a neder, and then we assume that that neder is a neder al dat rabim, because otherwise we'd say, what if you help? Because you could just say, well, he'll not be married now, he'll go do the avoda, then he'll marry her again, he'll get a hataras and darim done. So we say it's al dat rabim. So if you say, well, I don't understand, because we just said that he can find a way to get out of the rabbim. So he says, no. Rizikhan says, no, you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to say, maybe he'll not divorce her. I'm sorry, he's married to this woman, but once he takes a nether not to live with her anymore, and therefore he's going to have to separate from her, we say, okay, he can already do service in the Beit HaMikdash, you say, but he can do Hataras Nedarim. So you say, no, we make it a nether al dat rabim, a nether by the will of the people at large. So you say to me, but you just showed me examples of ways in which you can do Hataras Nedarim. And then once he's gotten remarried to her, and he's already violating the thing, we'll do Hataras Nedarim for him, because you just said to me, if somebody is already violated the nether, then we can be matter the nether, even a nether al dat rabim. So says reasonable inspector, that's not a worry, because this whole idea that we can be matter a nether, we can allow the nullification of an oath or the uprooting of an oath that was done al dat rabim, if the person already violated it, it's only where they're no longer sinning and they're now doing tshuva. So for example, if our shochtim were still saying, no, we're going to keep shechting even without permission from you, so then the reasonable inspector is saying, I wouldn't have even come close to thinking that we could do anything about them. So too, this Kohen, who's married to a divorcee, if he's married to a divorcee, so while he's still married to her, he's still doing the sin. There we're not matir nedarim for him. So once he takes a ned there that he won't stay married to her, and then does service, we allowed to do service to be the mikdash, because there's no way out of that neder for him, and we know he's going to have to separate from her. So that's counter example number one in the answer is we say you can do you can be matir a neder for a person who's already violated it, the neder, even if the neder was a neder al dat rabim, even if the vow was taken with and explicitly made subject to the will of the populace at large, which would prevent you from being able to do real hatara, prevent you from being able to nullify or to allow the vow as Chachamim, as sages, are able to do. That only applies where there's no continuing sin going on. So that's why the Kohen case, where he's married to a woman he's not allowed to be married to, if he takes the dead there, we would have to worry there's going to be a Hatara there. I just want to point out a phrase that he throws in. He says that in the case where we're saying you can do it, it's Mistoma Nechal Rabim Lat Silo Min Isser Chamor. What makes us allowed to be matter the dead there is that we are saving him, and we want to save him from serious sins. So by being matir the neder, we can make it that he hasn't violated the neder, which is a very serious sin. But where he's still sinning anyway, then we didn't care. Then we don't care. So that's an underlying attitude that people sometimes forget. Where somebody's continuing to sin, that's not where we're moved to help them. We're very moved to help them once they've said we're looking for the way back. But if they're still sinning, then we don't. And that's what the difference between these two kinds of nedarim al dat rabim, these two kinds of oaths that were taken according to the will of the general populace. If the person's already trying to repent, that's an oath that the populace will want to try to help him get rid of because it's a barrier to tshuva. But if he's still sinning, then with the populace, we don't think the populace has any interest in allowing him to, in finding ways to help him out and be better, because he's still sinning and we don't care to help him in that situation. Another possible counterexample is a woman whose husband passed away, and the orphans or the heirs are concerned about whether, if we pay her the ketubah, they're concerned about whether that doesn't mean that she'll get it twice, meaning maybe the husband already gave her money and she's not telling us the truth about the money that she already got from her husband, and she tries to collect her ketubah. So she's supposed to, before she takes any money from the yitomim, she's supposed to take an oath. So the question is, and the oath will be that if I wrongly take money from you, this or this will be prohibited to me, and we think it's a serious thing, and we assume that that's good enough that she won't violate it. So Tosa say, well, but what if she does a Hataras Nedarim? So Tosa says, well, the Gemara could have said that madrinan la al dat rabim. We could have said that she took the oath not on her own account, but on the account of the public at large. So there too, if we've already said that we can do hatarat nedarim if she's already violated, why not? Why wouldn't she say to herself, if she knows the halacha, let's say, why wouldn't she say to herself, well, I'll take the money, I'll do this, I'll do the wrong thing, and once I've already violated it, they will do hatarat nedarim for me because I'll already be on my way back to tshuva. She says, nope, that's not a problem either, because in that situation, we're also not going to allow her to hatarat nedarim, because we wouldn't do it where her hatarat nedarim affects somebody else's financial situation. So in this case, it's only a word, because that's the whole problem here. The heirs are worried that she's taking more from the estate than she's allowed to. So if we foster her being able to violate an oath by her knowing that if she violates the oath, then she'll be able to come to us and get Hatar Nedarim, and then it will be like, the oath isn't there, that will affect the other heir, the heirs to the estate. We don't do that as well, either. So, the court inspector is sort of narrowing the case we're allowed to do. When he says we're allowed to, once somebody has transgressed an oath, be matir it, once we say that, what we mean is, meaning that if somebody's already violated it, an oath, then we can do it because we're trying to help them facilitate shuva. Now, this, as we've already seen, this creates, from the example, this creates a certain moral hazard that you might just have people, even on their own, who will take an oath of that rabbim that only affects them, doesn't affect somebody else, and they'll violate it, assuming that they're going to be able to get a hatara done later. That's a problem, but certainly where it financially affects somebody else, like with the widow and the heirs, or where the person is still sinning at the moment they try to get the hataras nedarim, that too would be a reason that we can't do hataras nedarim. Okay, so coming back to our case, sorry, just one last point about the widow and the heirs case. If we don't allow her to be matir the net there, that will also be a reason to encourage her or to sort of force her into some agreement with the heirs and to find a resolution to the concerns about how the estate was being done. So that's another reason why we wouldn't want to be matir the net there. Now, another example is, if somebody is makdish their nechasim, somebody says that all of their property should be hektish, and there are a lot of reasons people do this. One is to avoid having to pay debts to other people, right? There are positive reasons, also negative reasons. So there too, if the neder was without rabbim, you can't be matrit because then you're causing a loss to hektish, the Beit HaMikdash. And again, it'll be similar to the widow in the sense that for as long as her neder's out there, or his neder's out there, whoever the person is who was makdish all the property, as long as that neder is out there and sort of hanging over this person, they'll try to find a way to get Hektish to agree to give them back some of the stuff, or sell them back some of the stuff, or make some arrangement. So until that arrangement is made, you don't want to step into the process and just give the out of, we can do the Hataras Nedarim for you, and that's why that's an issue. But in cases where it only affects this person, and it's already done, and all these things are going on, so then you don't have to worry about, then the court inspector says, there's room to say that the rabbin would agree that we can be matir this person's neder, and that's all the more so true of a shivua, right? A neder is where I make something prohibited to me by, I just say, if this happens, this should be prohibited to me. But a shivua is where I take an oath. And also where I promise to do something or not do something. And there, the Gemara in Shavuot says that Hashem punishes the whole world for violations of oaths. Even, and this is an important point, usually in Halacha we say that if somebody has the ability to stop another person from doing the wrong thing and they don't do it, I have a way to stop them or to remonstrate with them, speak to them, or in some way get them not to violate the Torah in some way. So usually I bear some responsibility for it if I don't do that. But in the case of an oath, the Gemara tells us, even those who didn't have the possibility, who could not have, did not know how to, or did not have the ability to stop the person from doing anything, nonetheless, the whole world bears responsibility for false oaths. That's a cautionary comment that I think is too often not paid attention to, right? False oaths are serious, serious things, and the fact that those happen is a mark on the entire world. And so in our context, that's why, says Rizal Spector, we have reason to think that the rabbin would want to be matir this shvua, would want to nullify this oath, because they're implicated in it as well. The fact that it was violated is a black mark on them, and that gives us more reason to think that they would want to allow hatara of this oath. They wouldn't want to allow us to get rid of this oath. And he throws in that he thinks halakhically, and I don't know, he doesn't quote a source for this, but he thinks halakhically, whenever we can help somebody avoid a punishment for something they've done, if there's a halakhically valid way to do so, it's not like we just help them avoid it, there's a halakhically valid way to do so, then we are required and supposed to do so. And all the more so for the Chavodat, even though that's not the only opinion, the Chavodat that I mentioned before, that made this, turns this into a nevela, right? The Chavodat had held that if somebody violates an oath not to shecht, and then shechts, so then everything they shecht not because of any physical problem with the shechita, with the ritual slaughter, just by virtue of the fact that they had taken an oath not to slaughter, that makes them, renders them liable for, that makes the meat, nevela, non-kosher meat, and they've sold non-kosher meat. But, so there, if the rabbim knows, if the general people know that there's a meat out there that's been eaten already, that was non-kosher meat, but if they nullify the oath, it will count as kosher. It will no longer count as non-kosher meat. That's yet another reason that we'd want it, that we can assume that the rabbin would want the oath to be nullified, because that will help many other people who are innocent people have gotten away from the problem of having eaten non-kosher meat. And there's a Rivash that actually said that in terms of removing a michshel, removing a stumbling block from people, that would be a good reason to be matir a nether, even a nether al dat rabim. So even though it's true that the Chavos Das is not the only opinion on this issue, and there are many who hold that it's not true, but it makes sort of what's called a sniff, another added factor in allowing us to be matir, and allowing us to say that we can be matir this nether, we can remove this nether, this oath, or this shvuah that these people took, they would never shecht again if they violated their oath, so we're going to remove that for them to let them come back to doing shechita. So in our, then, one more piece, another piece that he adds in is, the Mabit had a tshuva, had a responsive, again, which is not necessarily accepted completely the halacha, but it's a responsive in which he said that if you had two people who swore to do something, they swore not to sign a certain deed or you know, to agree to a certain condition or to a certain arrangement, that was the agreement that they made, and they did it together. If one of them passes away, the Mabit said, then the other one is freed of the oath. He doesn't even need to do a Hatar Sandarim. It's not that he's not allowed to get a Hatar Sandarim. He doesn't need to do it because the oath was taken the two of them together, and if it's not the two of them together, then it's not the same oath anymore. That would mean, therefore, that if you could say that, not just to say, here, where one of the shochtim had apparently passed away in the interim, you could say the whole shavua, the whole oath that they had taken, was no longer in place, and therefore you could ignore it. So that's not, he's not willing to say that that's halacha, he's willing to say that that's a snif lahatir. It adds more material to say that it's okay. With all that, he stresses that they still need tshuva chamura. They need to do things to show their, because we have to make sure that the reason for the tshuva chamura is we have to make sure that people don't get used to the fact that they can violate a shvua, an oath, and then get out of it by doing hataras nedarim. And therefore, you have to make a tshuva chamura. Tshuva chamura means they have to do some serious sets of things. They have to work really hard to get rid of the stain on their reputation, as it were. They're rid of their stain on what they did, on how they acted, and all those kinds of things. So whatever that would be, he doesn't lay out what that would be, but it needs to be something serious and significant, whatever that could be. You can imagine, it could be a fine, it could be years of community service, it could be whatever it could be, but because they have children and we want to help them be able to support their children, then he's going to say, you can be matir. But then he says, but they have to be suspended for 30 days. They can't do shechita for 30 days, and they can't make the money off of shechita for 30 days, and then afterwards, they have to agree to certain terms and conditions that make clear, with great warnings, that they will adhere to the new rules that will make sure that they do things right, and then it'll be up to this rabbi who's writing to him. He says, you know better what they should do and how they should do it. You can set it up, but that's what it's got to be. Now, that 30 days, he points out, is only if that's less, more time than they violated their oath for. But for however much time they violated their oath, by meaning, for however much time they violated their oath and they allowed themselves to do shechita when they weren't supposed to against their oath, they certainly have to forego shechita for those numbers of days. And that's based on the Gemara that says that if somebody has profited wrongly in a certain way over a certain period of time, they have to, at the very least, give up those profits for that number of days into the future as well. So it's another attitude about, remember, he is doing his best to try to help this man out of a situation, try to give these men a way to get back into shechita, but nonetheless, he thinks the fundamental rules are that when you've profited wrongly, you'd have to step away from that profit-making venture for that period of time at least, and then for 30 days more, basically saying, as a punishment. They have to accept that punishment as part of what it is. These are all attitudes that I think are very often not noticed today. Even and remember that it's a situation where he's fundamentally trying to help these men out. So that is our first tshuva, our first response of the day. You have a bonus one today because this one is not quite enough time to fill up our time, but it makes very important points about what you do when people flout the system, when people violate the halakha they're supposed to keep and they don't keep it the way they're supposed to keep it. So here, Rizalon Inspector has an oath that they took, and theoretically the oath that they took should have been an oath that they couldn't violate at all, and yet instead of that, he finds ways to uproot that oath, to have a chacham, allow a chacham to say the oath is no longer in effect or shouldn't have, would not have been taken to begin with, even though it was an oath of that rabbim in all the ways that we've seen. So that's Rabbi Yisrael Spector working to help people get back to being able to earn their livelihood, even as at the same time he requires tshuva chamur of them. He tries a significant, serious tshuva of them, and he also requires a suspension for the number of days in which they improperly profited, plus a 30-day suspension just to make the point that they needed to be suspended. So that is Rizal Elchanan Spector's discussion of writings about these shochtim, these ritual slaughters, who did the wrong thing. Now, just a very brief tshuva. There's a tshuva in Aseh Lecha Rav, Rav Chaim David Halevi, who I ordinarily am a big fan of. This is from volume 8, response number 20. And I'm doing it very briefly because we only have a couple of minutes left. But he's asked about a Sephardi woman who married an Ashkenazi man. And this is a letter that was normally, when he says, I got your letter, he only mentions the date. But here he puts the year on it too. It's from the 10th of Shvat of Tufshin Memvav of 1986. 10th of Shvat of 1986. Sephardi woman marries an Ashkenazi man, and she wants to know. So he, Rav Chaim David Halevi, had written an article in Tchumen which said that a woman is supposed to adopt the customs of her husband, and he held that very strongly, and that's a topic for another time. I think I have to see the article in Tchumen, but I think he would have said something like, you want to build a family together, then they should have as much as possible one joint custom, and therefore he would have said, not saying he's right, but he would have said the husband's supposed to set the tone of the household, so she should adopt the customs of the husband, they'll build their house together. In any case, this man writes him a letter. He says, where because Rav Chaim David Halevi had said that anything that doesn't cause any kind of a rift in the household, if it's not going to cause a problem for the two of them, then she's allowed to stick to her old custom and to keep with the custom that she grew up with. So the man writing him the letter says, so what about davening? When it comes to making brachos or to davening, can she daven in the Ashkenazi, in the Sephardi way that she's used to, and she wants to continue davening that way? And then it also comes up in terms of whether she can do things that Ashkenazi women do, such as make brachos on mitzvos that women aren't obligated in. The general principle is that Sephardi women don't make brachos on mitzvos seish as man gram, on time-related mitzvot. So could this Sephardi woman make brachos on these things, or should she stick with her Sephardi practice, let's say making a bracha on Sefiras HaOmer, on shaking of the lulav, and the husband doesn't care. The husband says, it's fine with me if she wants to or doesn't want to. She wants to know if she can. So that's the question. So Chaim Talia says it's true that in general prayer is a private thing. So since a prayer is a private thing, she should, when she's praying on her own and to herself, she can say whatever words are comfortable for her. That would mean she can say the Sephardi nusach that she was accustomed to growing up, and her husband couldn't disagree, even if he did. In this case, he wasn't disagreeing. He was just curious what the halacha was, but he couldn't disagree even if he wanted to. But if she goes to shul, so in shul, and this would have been true either way, in shul, she can't do anything to be different than the other people in shul, because that's a problem of what's called lotit godudu, of creating divisions among the Jewish people. Then, and this is the part that gets, to my mind, a little stickier, he says, in our situation, he thinks that you should probably... Sorry, the woman was from an Ashkenazi family, and she married a Sephardi. I apologize. So in this situation, Chaim David Halevi, who's a Sephardi, says he thinks that you should tell the Ashkenazic woman that it would be better for her if she changes her nusach hatfilah. In everything else, he's still holding by what he said, that, you know, private stuff she can do in the way that she wants to, and it doesn't can't, and it's not a problem, it's not an issue, and the husband can't object to it. But in this situation, it would be preferable for her to pick up the Sephardic nusach anyway, he says, because, and here's the claim that's a complicated one, the Chida, who's a Sephardi, already quoted the Arizal, who has a, say, the Arizal is the, you know, the first person to do Lurianic Kabbalah in the 1500s, is a major important Mekubal, and he had claimed that there are 12 different sort of avenues for prayer to reach Hashem, like the 12 tribes. He understood that in heaven there are 12 gates for the 12 tribes, and there's a different, there originally was sort of a different a venue or avenue of tefillah for each tribe. Each tribe had its own way of davening. But the Arizal had said, the Chida quotes, that the Nusach of the Sfardim can make it through any one of those gates. And if that's true, then, and they quote the Maharash Dam there, says also that the Minig of the Sfardim is the better one because the language of Sfardim Nusach is clearer and more understandable and better written, basically. So Rav Chaim Dovid Levi is saying, so for all that you see, that Sephardi davening is better. So he says, somebody will say to me, well, the Maharash Dam was a Sephardi. So of course he saw it that way, as was the Chida, as Rav Chaim Dovid Levi. I'm adding that. So he says, well, but the Arizal wasn't a Sephardi, and the Arizal was Ashkenazi, and yet he changed all his davening to the Sephardi Nusach, something approaching the Sephardi Nusach. That's why you have a lot of people today who are from Ashkenazic stock, and yet they daven Nusach Sephardi. Like Hasidim do it, there will be various people who do it. So that's a whole big issue that comes up. But there are those, plenty of those, including Rav Chaim Dovid Halevi, and I'm not going to question it here, but I find it interesting, but there is a large group of people who would say the Sephardi Nusach of davening is the better Nusach, and since it can be established as the better Nusach, that if the woman comes to us and asks our opinion, we would tell her it's better for you to switch because Sephardi davening is better. In terms of Birchas Tzvirus HaOmer, he says, I've already had a psak at length where I said that I think that women, even Ashkenazi women who are married to Ashkenazim, shouldn't make a bracha on Tzvirus HaOmer for whatever reason it is. He doesn't tell us here. And when it comes to making a bracha on Lulav, he said there he thinks, in another writing of his, another sefer of his called Mekor Chayim Shalem, there he says, I thought and I've shown that I think even Sephardi women are allowed to make the bracha, and therefore they could do that. So fundamentally, though, Ashkenazi woman marries a Sephardi, she has to adopt his customs in anything that affects their relationship with each other. But if it's private, she can stick to her own, except in case where it would be better for her to switch anyway. And that is Rav Chaim Dovid Halevi for the 10th of Shvat, coming after Rav Yitzchak Lonergan Spector about the question of nullifying an oath that was taken al dat rabim. That is a responsible day for the 10th of Shvat. Have a great day.